Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.
This was going to be wild, weird, you know, talk about mysteries, the unconscious. It doesn't get weirder than that.
I tried ignoring things. I tried addressing things. We tried therapy together. I tried to change myself. I tried to change everything around me.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Hankin. And this week on the podcast, The Hard Work of Becoming.
Two stories about women who are redefining themselves. This first story, shared by Desiree Smith, is really just invites you into her world in such a complete way. Take a listen.
A couple years ago, I was sitting around with myself, and I realized that I had been conceived by homeless drug addicts. And you would think that I would have already known this about myself, and I did, but I had just never put it to myself that way, never thought that that's how my story started. But it did, so that's where we'll start tonight. I was conceived by homeless drug addicts in 1977, maybe 1976, somewhere in South Florida. There's a lot of mysteries about that part of my life, but don't worry, I have really turned out pretty okay. I have a place to stay. I am not addicted to any substances, if you don't count, thank you, if you don't count social media. And best of all, I definitely don't live in Florida. Yeah. Let's all take a moment, not only to be grateful that we don't live there, but think about the people who do. So, and by that I mean the people who are, you know, suffering. So anyway, so I don't live in Florida, and it was 1977, maybe 1976, but fast forward, 2021, and my partner of 2 years turns to me one day and says, "Sometimes you are really mean to me, and if you don't stop, I'm gonna break up with you." So I turned out pretty okay, because I got some help, and some of that help was from therapists. And here I was in need of a therapist again. Have I mentioned, I think I forgot to mention, that I'm a therapist? So luckily, a few months before this happened, I had gone to a training on a type of therapy that I had never heard of before. Intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy, and I was astonished. I've been a helping professional for 20 years, and the therapist presented his work by video, and I saw him and his patient do in 30 minutes what most clients and therapists can't accomplish in a year, and I knew I wanted to learn how to do that. I actually found my calling. But first, it turned out I needed to find someone to do that to me. So I did. I called 4 or 5 people. I got started with a therapist who turned out not to be the right fit, but we talked about it, and she referred me to Lisa. Lisa had done hundreds of hours of training with the person who developed the therapy, and magically, more astonishingly, she was accepting new clients. So ISTDP is like most therapies. Your therapist holds you with lots of care and respect, but also these therapists are really active, really assertive, can be really confrontational. And so they offer something called a trial therapy. You show up, ask for the help that you want, they give it to you, see if it works, and then you also decide if it works, if this is how you want to be helped. During our trial therapy, I remember she said to me, "What do you feel towards me right now?" And I said, "I don't know how I feel towards you, but I've got this sensation in my legs. My legs are tingling, and I love it when this happens. Anytime I watch a video on the internet of people protesting, I get this sensation, and I love it. It makes me feel alive." And she said, that just tells me that you don't know how your anger works. And I didn't quite know what she meant, but I wanted to. I could tell she knew what she meant. So I came back for the next session, the second session. This was going to be really intense. ISTDP is all about unlocking the unconscious, really getting to the heart of the matter. And like any part of us that protects us, it's no easy task. If you're doing heart surgery, for example, you have to get through the rib cage, and you can't summarize the rib cage to the rib cage and validate it. You're really going to have to get in there, do some tough work. I compare these therapists, like if I get poetic about it, to a scalpel and a brick wall and a puffy cloud all at the same time. They make really precise, planned cuts that are almost painless. They're really firm, and you can lean against them, or you can just crash into them over and over again. It's your choice. And like those big white clouds from far away, they seem one way. But if you do the work and you get up close, you climb the mountain, get on the plane, you see that there's something more to it. There's something different. So this was going to be wild, weird. You know, talk about mysteries, the unconscious. It doesn't get weirder than that. We've got the deep sea, we've got outer space, and we've got our own minds, right? So I was ready. I was in the waiting room. This was going to be painful sometimes, surprising sometimes, and it was going to be expensive. I had gotten a part-time job to pay for this, but I was ready. And again, 15 minutes early, that's how you know that I really, really wanted it. So I'm there in the waiting room, and this woman spots me from 30 feet away, and she says, "Are you here for the therapist?" And I say, "Yeah." And she says, "She's not here." And I said, "No, I've got an appointment." And the woman paused and said, "She's not coming." And this is when I realized that something was going on, maybe traffic or an emergency. I said, "What do you mean?" And the woman looked at me and said, "She died." And I said, "What do you..." And she said, "Here, I'll get her son on the phone." So she called Lisa's son and handed me the phone. And he introduced himself to me, and I introduced myself to him, and he explained what happened. And I said, "I'm so sorry." And he said, "No, I'm so sorry." And we hung up the phone, and I handed it back to the woman, and she walked away, and there I was, alone again. My first thought was, now I can buy that patio furniture that I've been wanting. My second thought was, now I don't have to do this. I don't have to figure out how my anger works. I don't have to talk about my parents. I had tried hard enough, right? And my third thought was not so much a thought as it was a realization that I was going to do this. I was going to get my patio furniture, and then I was going to get another therapist. Emily Dickinson has a poem. It goes, "After a great pain, a formal feeling comes." And I was sitting there in the waiting room, and that feeling was coming over me. And I love this feeling, too. It helps me stay present and connected under some really terrible situations. But if I let it go too far, it gets too far. It goes too far. So I'm sitting there, but I don't know what to do. She calls it a quartz contentment, and it is satisfying, but it's not quite right, this stony feeling. What do I do? Who do I call? Would I just send a text? What do you say? So all this is going through my mind when Lisa opens her door and says, "Are you ready?" And I look at her, and she looks at me. And I break the silence, and I say, "Someone just told me that you're dead." And she said, "Oh, no, come in." And she sat me down, and she explained what happened. Her friend had died, the other therapist in the office. The woman that she shares this space with had died suddenly. And I said, "I am so sorry." And she said, "I'm so sorry." And then she said, "What does this bring up for you?" And I said, well, it really just reminds me that the next time I see my biological mother will be at her funeral. And that began the most transformative therapeutic relationship of my life. I learned a lot about my anger that year, how it works, how it doesn't work. You know, none of us are born mean, right? We're born to love or maybe get angry, to be excited, to grieve. But somewhere along the way, when we feel those things, we notice that the people we depend on get kind of weird. So we stop feeling and figure out how to do everything but. So I knew how to get mean, but I didn't know how to get angry. I also learned a lot about how I see myself and how I worry other people see me and how that might have happened. You know, it could be that the people who raised me didn't quite see me for who I really was. And that's what happened in the waiting room, right? That woman saw me. She saw the dead therapist's client. And that's who I became. Just like a kid, I didn't know any better. And it wasn't the worst 15 minutes of my life, you know. I figured out that I really want patio furniture. And that I really wanted to change more than I wanted to stay the same. And thank goodness for Lisa, right? She came out and cleared that up. And I want that for all of you. I hope that you have. Someone in your life who sees you for who you really are, or at least who you really want to be. And I hope that you do not have to pay them $250 an hour. If you do have those people in your life, or even one person in your life who does that, your chances are really so much better at being who you really are, becoming who you really want to be. And the other thing that I learned is that it could be that I have been who I really am since the day I was born, all of us, right? Maybe even since the day that we were conceived. Thank you.
So what's so interesting about Desiree's story is that when, as can happen with the stoop, is I might know or Laura might know someone personally, and that's how they end up sharing a story on our stage. And we're so grateful to those folks, to everyone for sharing a story. But especially those folks who are like, you know what, I think I might have this story, and they just decide to mention it to us. So Desiree mentioned this story to me as like a funny little lark. Like,
yeah, people have to be careful around us, because we'll just, there'll be a stray comment, yeah. And we're seizing on it like a dog with a bone.
She's like, yeah, there was this time that I thought my therapist had died, and I was like, oh my God. So, but then she did this incredible work, as she's wont to do, because she's an incredible human being who's hardworking and constantly challenging herself, to make it so much more than just a funny tale of a mistaken identity. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. Grateful to her. Thanks, Desiree. We'll be back with another story in just a minute.
This next story by Susanna Sung is also just a great tale of someone who has always been a rule follower, deciding to do things a little differently.
I am the child of immigrants from Hong Kong. The best thing a Chinese child can be is guai. That is the Cantonese word for good. Obedient. You do as you're told. As a child of immigrants, you're always also on, scanning the room, figuring out what the rules of engagement are, figuring out what is expected of you. When you're also always observing, you're also very quiet, which then helps perpetuate your reputation of being a very guai child. So I got older, grew up, started dating. When you know it, men would tell me I could never have an Asian wife. Men would tell me, all of this unsolicited, by the way, I could never have mixed race children. They, right? They would tell me this on the first date, the third date. One gentleman had the good timing to tell me 6 months in. And here I am thinking, who said I wanted to marry you in the first place? And who said I wanted kids at all? But why? Why are those the two things I was most outraged about? Probably because I didn't have the words back then to call racism for what it was. And probably because I was in denial that they were really only looking for situationships. So I started to hope for someone who wouldn't leave me. I hoped to minimize how many more times my heart would be broken. Date a nice guy, people said. Okay, so I met a guy. He seemed nice. We got married after several years of dating because that's the next step, right? After years of dating? I mean, I'm not stupid. My friends had kept asking, so how are things with... And I've seen all the movies, I've read all the stories, happily ever after. This is what you do after you date someone for years, right? And he hadn't left me. We were good to go? Turns out we were not good to go. It turns out that we had a lot of issues in our marriage. I'm not going to go into the tales tonight because it's about me, not him. But I will tell you that at the end of every tale, I was never more lonely than in that marriage. I will tell you that at the end of every tale, turns out we did not share the same values. And it turns out that at the end of every tale, he just was not willing to show up to do the work that's required to make a marriage work. That's all right, because I'm guai. I can do all the work, right? I got this. I tried ignoring things. I tried addressing things. We tried therapy together. I tried to change myself. I tried to change everything around me. And with every change, a little part of me died inside. But I got what I wanted. Got a guy that wasn't going to leave me. It got to the point where I just couldn't even recognize myself anymore. But here I was raising two young children. So I thought, I know what to do. I am going to slow down the dying every day a little bit. But here's the thing with kids, when you look at them, you are reminded of their innocence, of their potential, of their curiosity, their joy, their goodness. Children are good without being obedient. But here's the thing, though, with kids, is that they look to you to see what they're supposed to do. And I realized they cannot think that this is a relationship worthy of having. This is not a relationship that is respectful and fulfilling. I did not want them to be trapped in a relationship where they were dying inside every day. And there was one moment where I knew what I had to do. Because I'm a rule follower, I listened to the flight attendants before every flight. And I was reminded that when all hell breaks loose, when that oxygen mask comes down, you put yours on first before you can turn and help those around you. I realized I had to save myself so that I could save my children. But how do I do that? I made promises, happily ever after. I took a vow, till death do us part. I was serious. I meant it. I am responsible. I said, I will love you forever. Forever. It turns out that forever is a very long time. And I struggled with how am I ever going to trust myself ever again? How am I going to tell anyone else that I will love them forever? How do I disappoint my children, my parents, everyone around me in such deep ways? Then I thought, oh, my parents. My parents, they had a couch in the living room by a window. Stick with me, this makes sense. And as a child, I learned all the contours of the couch. the texture of the upholstery, the colors of that fabric. And when I was a little older, my parents asked for help moving the couch. And it was then that I noticed that part of the upholstery had been faded, where the sun had been shining day after day for years. But it was only then that I noticed it was faded. That was me. Recognizable, but so, so faded. And yet here I am, I still need to raise my children so that they are equipped to live their best lives. And here I am, a faded shell of a memory. I realized I had to break my promises before I had the answers to these struggles. I had to do this because I had to not only find myself again, but I had to figure out who I wanted to be, what colors I wanted to be, what resonated, what's going to stick. And so I started doing these really new and terrifying and scary things to see what would resonate and who I wanted to be. Some of those things for your entertainment? Drumming, still terrifying, that stuck. Flying a plane, so terrifying, did not stick. Running really long distances, it felt really good until it didn't. Old back. The flying trapeze, a literal disaster. Belly dancing, so not pretty. No, it wasn't good, Handling a gun, I know, I should not be armed. That was not good. The hardest thing that I had to do was dare to have the audacity to fail. I had to do these things because I needed my children to know they can do hard things, that you can be scared and brave at the same time, that they have been given Mary Oliver's one wild and precious life to lead. I needed them to know that you are not just passively who you are, but that you have the agency to be who you want to be. I needed them to learn to trust themselves and see what resonates for them. Because I had not trusted myself. I had not trusted all those red flags of my ex-husband. Because I was holding on so tight to the narrative that I was supposed to be married. I know my children will make their mistakes, but I don't want them to make mine. And so people thought that I was a promise keeper, a rule follower, but they were mistaken. It turns out, instead, I am a lifesaver. Thank you.
Susanna's great. Look on her like social media. You'll see all these various pursuits she's done over the years. The trapeze, the drums. She's
flying.
Yeah, flying. Wow. She is a real adventurer.
Sharing a story at the Stoop.
Yes. Yeah. I think that was on.
Yeah,
her.
For sure. Yeah. If it's on your bucket list, you can always find us at stoopstorytelling.com, and there will be information about upcoming shows as well as all of the stories from our previous shows that you can listen to. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for being our producer, and we will be back soon with more stories from the Stoop.
Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.